You're listening to Data Driven Performance, presented by UVic Formula Racing.
All right, we are here with Matt as usual, because me and Matt seem to be on all of these. Might be by design, I don't know. And then we are joined by Jacob, the current and last year's chassis lead, to talk about all things frames and static members.
Yes, very fun. Hey guys, how are you?
We're great.
Well, oh man, I didn't know we were doing this on a live audience. Man, that was so convincing.
Yeah. wow, so, there's actual expectations or something? What?
Yeah, it's scary stuff. So why don't we start off with Jacob, how about you introduce yourself a little bit? I know I kind of gave away most of it, but introduce yourself a little bit and maybe talk about kind of what you do on a regular basis with the team.
Yeah, so I'm the current chassis lead. I've been the chassis lead for a bit over a year now. And, you know, with the chassis, we mostly deal with the frame, which is, at least in our car, is a... like steel space frame. So that means, you know, steel tubes that get welded together in a bunch of triangles that eventually turn into the basis for a car. Essentially what chassis is one of my favorite ways of explaining it is a very complicated game of connect the dots. Whereas we get given a bunch of requirements by the other systems for where things need to be, and we need to kind of link them together and create a good platform that connects everything together and makes the car kind of easy to drive and reliable in, like, you know, vehicle dynamics wise, which I think you guys have covered already.
We haven't actually brought the vehicle dynamics people in to talk about vehicle dynamics. We have talked to them about competition, and I have given my thoughts on vehicle dynamics.
Oh, right. Yeah. I think we're going to have to do a longer one for bringing the VD guys in.
Yeah. It's a long discussion.
Yeah. Okay. Well, you know, just imagine, you know, what vehicle dynamics is and chassis is trying to not affect them at all. Basically trying to take everything that they do and then make it connect together without changing any of, or without having them to change any of the tuning or math or anything that they do, as well as, you know, sizing for different drivers, trying to make the car kind of comfortable. I mean, that's kind of Ergo's deal, but also chassis. I mean, we don't really have an Ergo team right now, so.
Yeah, I think you guys have been foisted with a lot of those responsibilities.
Yeah, and, one thing that's I've learned recently actually is doing tabs is apparently quite a big thing. I didn't realize that on UV19 the tabs were a whole big thing because other systems designed them and they didn't fit properly, and then I think last year someone did them all, but and they were better, but still, I don't know. Yeah, so we do the tabs, all the welding as well, which is a lot more work than, well, you expect it to be a lot of work and then it's even more work. So as is with most things on FSAE.
You walked in for 6 hours and it ended up being 12.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or, you know, you come in for a day and you're like, I'm going to weld today. And then you do 8 hours of prep and go home and you're like, oh, I didn't even turn the welder on. Okay. Well, I guess that's tomorrow's job.
I guess that's the thing with everything always changing every year, and you know, the amount of planning that goes into everything. It's just crazy how often, like, you know, budgeting time is, you know, ends up being a lot longer than you expect.
Yeah, exactly. Or yeah, even I think the last time I was in working on the frame, So the entire frame got put in like the little attic above the shop. Mm-hmm. And I was there with Zach, who's the, he's been on here before, the VD lead. And we went up there and we're like, oh, okay, just to finish off the day, we're going to pull it down. It takes like an hour to pull everything down. Because it was, you know, you have to climb like a kind of sketchy ladder to get up there.
The vastly less sketchy than it used to be, but still sketchy ladder.
Yeah, yeah, the kind of sketchy ladder.
Because the ladder used to be 2x4s that were screwed into the wall, and you basically just had to like rock climb your way up.
Okay, so less sketchy that now they're 2x4s that are screwed into spacers that are screwed into the wall. So you have about 2 inches of space for your fingers to go on.
Yeah, so you can actually get a full grab on the ladder instead of having to like finger hold it.
Very nice. Yeah, so I'm not sure how they got it all up there, to be honest, but they put basically the entire chassis in a cardboard box. It was probably like, I don't know, it was probably like 100, no, like the whole chassis is like 80 pounds. So it didn't have the front or main roll hoop. So it was probably like 70 pounds. And trying to get that thing down on the ladder, like I pulled it out and then was holding it, and I realized I can't go down the ladder. So I had to hand the pieces to Zach one at a time until it got like light enough to be able to go down the vertical sketchy ladder.
But I wonder if we could actually screw in like some sort of, hooks or maybe in the ceiling, or get some sort of setup where we could almost hoist.
Like a dumbwaiter.
Yeah.
Rig up a pulley system.
Right?
Yeah, to send things up to storage. Yeah, no. Yeah, so anyway. And then I mean, back to the actual like kind of chassis stuff. The one thing we've realized this year is the EV chassis. So we went into this year thinking we wanted to keep the combustion and electrical chassis as similar as possible. So hopefully, like the hope was to just make two of the same chassis, mm-hmm. like have all the design done and then just build two of them and, you know, maybe adapt a few things, but really not much. And then looking at the rules, like poring over the rules and actually looking at it, we realized probably too late that, oh crap, we need to change the whole thing to make it actually rules compliant and like kind of good. So
not to mention the accumulator's humongous.
Yeah, that's a big thing actually. No, when I first I don't know, probably for the first month I was going off of, oh, we did some measurements and you just need to make the chassis like 5 inches wider to fit the accumulator. And I went, okay. You know, and Charlie said at the bottom of the main roll hoop, which is the roll hoop behind the driver, kind of the tallest point on the car. And he's like, oh yeah, just make the bottom 5 inches wider and it'll work. So I did that like on that assumptions and then started working on it. And then when I actually got the model in there, it's like, oh, this doesn't fit. Yeah.
Yeah. Maybe that's a good way to segue into, I feel like, because chassis is pretty rules heavy. And then, so for context, we recently just picked up, we found through our network of alumni and people associated with the team, basically one of the former team members from that team now works for UVic and had the 2005 car, so we just picked it up, and very clearly some of the rules have gone wildly different since then, because that car, the chassis is like, what's going on here?
Yeah, I mean the car looks pretty sweet, but
oh yeah,
it's like all, you know, it looks like very nicely formed aluminum paneling and stuff for the body, and it's
all fiberglass.
Oh, it's all fiberglass. Okay.
Yeah, it's really nice fiberglass.
Like, but yeah, no, it looks really sweet. And just, yeah, looking at the back end, the chassis, like, I don't know, like 6 inches wide where the wheels are or something.
Yeah, well, so it's like a bolt-on frame bit that just kind of like holds the differential, and that's where the wheels attach, and that bolts onto like the engine mounting points. And then the frame at the back is essentially all attached with bolts to the frame, like the front of the frame.
Oh, wow.
So it can like swing out of the way, and like you can take the engine out real easy, but it's not like welded. It's just like bolted to the roll hoop.
Oh, I'd like to see the, I wonder if they had to do like the equivalency, the structural equivalency calculations back then, because that sounds like such a pain.
Well, and I can promise you that they did not have template rules, because the driver like cell is super narrow, and the steering rack is like right where your legs would want to go. So you have to put your legs either under or over top of the steering rack.
Just steer with your knees, Blake.
You just slide it side to side. There's no wheel needed.
Yeah.
So really what we need to do is just replace or add to our steering wheel just two little cups that you can put your knees in so that you can just steer. And then
interesting design concept.
You know, looking for drivers on the team who are actually potentially like amputees as well. Because then you also have weight savings for sure. And, you know, you're being a lot more inclusive as well.
That's a nice way to put it.
You know, everyone deserves to drive a car.
Exactly.
I do love how the 05 car looks very like kind of 1960s-esque F1 style. Like with this just sort of like no real kind of aggressive like aero package and just like a very kind of slender design.
It looks like it's ready to kill you, just like the 1960s F1 car.
Yeah,
cool. It's a very narrow, very aggressive car.
Pretty sure we've evolved from ready to kill you to ready to maim you mildly.
I mean, I'm sure that isn't that like the FIA's slogan?
Probably. That's probably what they put at the rule book. At the front of the rule book, it says, this rule book is intended so that rather than killing you, it just intensely maims you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Welcome to the FIA. Maiming only.
I guess we should explain what the template rules are and like generally speaking what the frame rules are, because I can kind of speak to the template, but the rest of it, you know.
Yeah. So the template rules are that the cockpit or the driver envelope, I think it's called, which is the kind of, it's where the person sits, needs to fit the lowest fifth percentile women's size and the upper 95th percentile men's size, or the 95th percentile men's. So basically you need to be able to fit really big drivers and really small drivers in there. Mm-hmm. That's the template is represented by two circles of specified radiuses, or three circles. It's a stick person that sits in a specified position, and you put that on the top of your seat. And then you do where your seat is going to go. And you determine, you know, whether your cockpit fits the template or not. And then there's a vertical no-go zone where your legs are supposed to be, where you have kind of an area where you're not allowed to have any tubes or anything. Where you know where your legs go, and then a horizontal, what's called the horizontal template, which is kind of the same thing but around where your torso is, so you can't have any tubes or any piece of the chassis coming in there so that you have room for people and they won't be, they won't hit the chassis in a crash, or if they're, you know, contorted in a weird position trying to do a turn or something, as you know, happens sometimes.
Are you guys generally like in support of kind of the size, kind of driver sizing packaging rule?
I think it's definitely a good idea to have that it can fit anyone. Cause the idea is, you know, you can, if you were to bring this car to market or this chassis to market, you could drop anyone in it. It's a one size fits all kind of thing, you know? And then, you know, I think if it were to be kind of more true to what F1 racing is, I think you should be allowed to design kind of more around what your, who your drivers are. Mm-hmm. For us, it works pretty well because we have some pretty big drivers and some pretty small drivers.
For sure.
So it's a good template to follow. But yeah, other, I don't know, for other teams who maybe have picked specified drivers, it might, I think it would be more beneficial to be able to design around who you're, who's driving your car. Cause then you can, you know, create a little template as well, just like a plywood template, and set up kind of your cockpit and actually take measurements and have some hard data to design around, which, you know, gives you a lot more than the wishy-washy, like the stick person template than you get, that you get traditionally.
Yeah, it does definitely work out better for us because, as Jacob mentioned, like all of our drivers are all over the place. I mean, we've got, you know, anywhere from like 5'5" up to like 6'3". So it's all over the place as far as heights. And then it makes fitting everyone in a little bit easier because you've already kind of like with that 2005 car, you would never be able to fit a wide variety of people. So, I mean, it, on some level, it narrows down your driver pool because part, like, not only do they have to be a good driver, but they also have to fit whatever the, you know, kind of potentially arbitrary requirements of, you know, sized person that will actually fit in this car. Well, and then because there's four drivers for competition doing all the different events, it makes a lot of sense. Like if you had one driver or even maybe just two drivers doing the whole thing, it would probably be fine to size the car to the driver. But I think it's probably a good thing for them to have it set up so that it can fit like a wide variety of people.
Yeah. There's also the matter of egressing, which I don't know if you could do in the 2005 car.
Well, Pete tried, it did not happen. Pete was, well, he wasn't even trying to egress. He was just trying to get out and like couldn't get his legs out. So
yeah,
I'm sure with some practice he might be able to figure it out, but
I think that's another thing that a template's kind of good for, is even if you have smaller drivers, I guess if you design around them without the 5 second get out of the car because it's on fire in mind, then that might be a lot more, you know, difficult.
Totally. Actually, on the topic of like even crashing, are there any rules specifically in place for even like kind of crumple zones, kind of like regular cars, or even just like kind of front end impacts?
Yeah, so at the front of the car, there's the impact attenuator, which for us is just a big square of honeycomb aluminum. And it has to absorb a certain amount of energy. I think ours absorbs 900 kilojoules or so of energy. Ooh, that could be kilojoules or megajoules. I think it's kilojoules though, of energy before it's completely squashed, which is acts kind of as a crumple zone. And then that is bolted onto what's called the anti-intrusion plate, which is just a 16th inch sheet of steel that's welded to the front, to the front bulkhead of the car, which is the, you know, most front piece of the chassis. And that also has to, it has to withstand more than that. So like if you hit something dead on, nothing at the front is going to break and nothing can come in and hit your feet and legs and such. And then there's rules about the mounting points for the harness. I mean, because we have a 5-point harness in our car.
So I think it's 6.
Or 6-point harness.
Difference is very minimal.
Yeah. So then there's mounting rules for those and where the straps from those are allowed to go. Like part of the horizontal template as well is no, like there can't be any tubes or anything crossing the path of your harness straps, which makes a lot of sense.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, without having the like 6-point harness modeled in there, I could see someone like accidentally throwing someone in there. It's like, oh, this makes the chassis super stiff. That's awesome. And then you build it and you're like, oh crap. You know, our harness doesn't actually work now. So yeah. And then as far as everything on like side impacts, there's rules where you can't have a space. So there can't in a tube frame chassis, since you have tubes and then there's empty negative space in between your tubes, usually in the shape of triangles, you can't have a cylinder or like a circle of more than, or a cylinder of a diameter of 10 centimeters be able to pass through any of those.
Mm-hmm.
Just so that, you know, if something breaks off someone else's car or anything, you know, pretty substantial of a diameter of 10 centimeters or more can't pass through the side of the car and into the driver.
Gotcha. So protection against projectiles sort of thing.
Yeah. Yeah. And then with the electric car, actually, there's a rule where there needs to be a piece of the frame so that the motor, so there's a barrier that is a structural member between the motor and the accumulator. So you don't have the motor impacting the battery and then you have a big battery fire that you have to deal with.
Right.
If you're hit from behind or something of that respect. So, yeah.
And it's interesting that they like this, because the strictest rules by far for like crumple zone and where we assume, so, you know, kind of inferring from that where they assume you're going to be crashing is head on.
Yeah.
And I don't know if that's true or not, but I don't have any counter evidence because I've never actually seen either two cars crash into each other or a car crash into like a rigid barrier or anything. Mm-hmm. I think I saw one car accidentally bump into one of like the moving barriers where they like kind of set them up. They're like the concrete like wall on you see on like the side of highways and stuff,
right? Yeah,
but they're like plastic and they just put a little bit of water in them. I've seen one person crash into that probably going like 5 kilometers an hour because they like accidentally popped the clutch when they like stopped and then it like kind of bumped into it, but like right. They bumped into it, it wasn't like they actually ran into it. And I beyond that, I've never really seen like a collision in competition, so I think there's definitely a lot done on the event level to make sure that there isn't collisions, because no matter how, you know, how much they verify that we've done a good job and no matter how good the design, I think you're much better at preventing the collision from the get-go than designing the car around being able to handle a collision well.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly. And I with the harness as well, and kind of how the seat and headrest are supposed to be designed, impacts from the back are definitely like if something hits you from the back, you're a lot better off than if you hit something, which makes, you know, it kind of more sense that there's a bunch more safety regulations towards the front of the car.
Because Hans devices aren't mandatory, but at the same time, I don't think we're going at speeds that would require them, which is probably why they're not mandatory.
Yeah.
If we've got some time, Should we talk about different materials, kind of different schools of thought on the chassis design?
Oh yeah, cool. Yeah, I think that's probably something good. Well, aluminum is out of the question, if anyone was wondering about that. Mostly because no one can afford a big, huge oven to, you know, heat treat your aluminum after you weld it. And most people don't have the skill to weld aluminum as well because it's really hard. It basically turns into bubblegum if you try. It looks like bubblegum if you weld it. It doesn't actually do anything. I was actually looking at our fuel tank the other day, and some of the welds on there are kind of scary. But, you know, as long as it holds water and gas, right? That's all it needs to do. But wasn't there a team that came in with an aluminum chassis one year and they just got denied?
Oh, yeah. They came in with an aluminum chassis. And then that aluminum chassis never went back with them because I think they were a team from, like, they had to fly it in. And it's more expensive to fly it back than it is to just leave it there and do another one, because they're gonna have to do another one anyway. And so it just got left there basically. But yeah, I don't think they passed tech because they showed up with like an aluminum, well, it was not only was it an aluminum frame, but it was an aluminum frame made out of square tube.
Oh, that is really hard to do right. And I mean, even in industry, like, a lot of people don't really understand what you have to do. I know at least stories coming from the bike industry is at a co-op. I was talking to like a manufacturer in Taiwan, and, you know, kind of talking about, okay, how are you gonna, we wanted to get some aluminum frames done, and we were kind of talking about, you know, okay, you guys didn't quote for heat treating, like, what are you doing? And they're like, oh, it's fine, we don't need to heat treat it because we're using like 6061 heat treated welding rod on our 6061 heat treated tube. It's like, okay, but once you weld it, it's no longer heat treated. So yeah, so aluminum, not ideal.
Titanium probably for similar reasons.
Yeah, well, titanium, if you want to do it right, what a lot of people do is you actually have to weld it in an argon-soaked environment. So for big titanium jobs, they'll like flood warehouses with argon and seal them, and the welders actually go in with like pseudo scuba gear, like with their own oxygen tanks and stuff.
Wow.
Because it oxidizes super fast, and in order to keep any of like the welding clean, you need to keep it complete, like no oxygen in the environment at all. So like what a lot of people will have is just like a little box on a counter or something. And then you have your, you know, the classic are like in The Simpsons, the like rubber gloves to handle the nuclear like material and stuff in the reactor. Kind of like that, where you have rubber gloves and you just have a torch and your rod inside, and you have these rubber gloves so you can weld in a completely argon, you know, soaked environment. So yeah, titanium's other question. So we use 4130 chromoly, which is kind of a standard for race cars, just because it's that little bit of carbon content in the steel makes it gives it a lot better strength, and, you know, it's not that much heavier. It rusts quite easily, but that's not really an issue for us. So
I have seen it though.
Yeah.
Because sometimes we go out to test before the frame has been powder coated, because we're still like not totally sure on all the tabs being in the right spot, and it's a pain to remove, so hold off for a bit. But it was raining that day too, which didn't help. And you could just see like it basically rusted the instant a raindrop hit it.
Yeah, no, that's basically high carbon steel. That's what it'll do. So It's also it also is heat treated, I'm pretty sure, usually when you get it. And then when you weld it, it's no longer heat treated, because, you know, when you weld something, you bring it up to a temperature where it melts. And then with heat treating, like, you, when they actually do it, you melt it and you have a liquid, and then you cool it down to a normal temperature, and then you heat it up back to a certain temperature, and that basically changes the microscopic structure in the steel, which, or aluminum or whatever, which strengthens it up a decent amount. So when you actually weld it, you remove the heat treating, but that doesn't matter nearly as much on the steel, because it's, even mild steels, a lot stiffer than, say, like aluminum or something. And you're, you know, at those joints, it's not really a huge deal. And you don't, that's why, like, on a lot of things, you'll see cracking at welds kind of for that reason and others. But, you know, with us, it's, we haven't seen any failures there in the past, and it seems to be okay. So, yeah, that's kind of why we go with 4130 over like a mild steel or something, just because you get a ton more strength and stiffness out of it, even though it is more expensive. But, you know, it's better to have an 80-pound frame than a, you know, 150-pound frame with the same kind of characteristics. And then there's the carbon fiber monocoque, which is very expensive to produce, which is why we don't do it. I know we were looking at doing a cut and fold thing, which is essentially you take a flat sheet and you cut a bunch of notches into it, kind of like how they make cardboard boxes, actually. Mm-hmm. They have like a flat sheet, and then they fold it all together and, you know, glue it or tape it. And it's the same kind of idea as that, just with more complex shapes. So that would be almost doable for us. And then the super fancy way is to actually get a mold, which can cost up to like $100,000, $200,000, $250,000 for a mold for one chassis. And if you're changing the chassis all the time, that is really not ideal.
The Pagani sponsorship, where are you at?
Exactly. Or and then, you know, there's the whole, if you use prepreg, which is carbon sheets with the glue already in it, like with an adhesive in it, then you need to stick the whole thing in a big oven, which is kind of the same thing as, would cost the same as heat treating a frame, which I think if you take it to, I know at least heat treating aluminum is like $400, which is pretty expensive. And, you know, you need to find someone who has an oven and will, a curing oven, and will let you use it, which is also kind of an issue because, you know, Victoria is not necessarily a hub of industry.
Especially a hub of large carbon fiber manufacturing.
Yeah. Well, we have Viking, but I don't know if they do much manufacturing there. Or they're on the island, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, or I don't know if they do any manufacturing there, but yeah, so I mean, carbon fiber monocoque would be ideal because they're usually quite a bit stiffer, which is what you're aiming for. Kind of the big number to hit actually is your torsional rigidity, which is essentially if you were to lock down the rear wheels and twist the front wheels, how hard is it to twist the front wheels? And that kind of has the most effect on the vehicle dynamics of the car, where, you know, if you're taking a hard corner and your suspension is compressing because, you know, the car is leaning into the corner and you're taking those forces. But if your suspension is compressing into your frame, which isn't stiff enough, then your frame is compressing and your car is actually not doing what you think it's doing. So, you know, if you have, say, on the suspension side, you're like, oh, we want, you know, suspension with 400 pounds per inch. That's the spring rate we're going to use. But if that's connected to a chassis that's essentially a noodle, which in the direction of the shock has a, you know, spring coefficient of, you know, heavily simplified, but a spring coefficient of, say, 200 pounds per inch, then you really have 200 pounds per inch, and that's kind of your max that you can do. So it really kind of limits the tunability of the suspension. So if you have a good torsional rigidity number, or a good torsional rigidity, then that makes, that's what dictates a good chassis, you know, really boiling things down to the simplest terms.
Comes back to not upsetting the vehicle dynamicists.
Basically, yeah, it's, you know.
I'm sorry, did you say the peanut gallery? I'm kidding.
Vehicle dynamics love and suspension are the parents getting divorced, and chassis the kid trying to keep them together.
We keep them together. Oh, man. That's an analogy. Oh, gosh. Do you find, being sort of the connect the dots part of the team, like in chassis, a lot of kind of problems get discovered, like with chassis, like on things that need fixing and stuff? Like,
I mean, definitely, especially with the chassis. I know recently I had kind of for the EV car, a draft model kind of finished, and then Pete threw it in, started building a working car assembly with it, and realized like, oh, the rear bell cranks hit the chassis. It's like, okay, well, it's a good thing this is a draft.
Yeah.
You know, and stuff like that. So it's, yeah, because, you know, without that piece, the all the other all the other parts of the car, they can kind of design around what their constraints are, but they don't necessarily know how that fits into everything else. So until you build a working car assembly with everything in it, you know, that's when you kind of discover the problems, which it's really good that this year we're doing that early. I know last year we've left that kind of late to starting to put that together, but yeah, no, trying to change the ways on that one and find the problems.
Totally. Yeah, that's cool though. I mean I'm no engineer obviously, but you know, being I don't know,
that's surrounded good by them.
Yes, just surrounded by them. Oh yeah,
our awesome. Engineering students.
Yes,
we can't call ourselves students. Engineers because we don't want to get sued
legally. Exactly. Speaking for legal reasons.
Yeah, but a student. Yeah, but of course, I mean, not even business students, people who haven't really done any business schooling or anything will, you know, have entrepreneur in their bios and everything.
Yes, I'm an engineering entrepreneur.
Oh, yeah, I actually deliver newspapers, but to like 10 neighborhoods, you know, so I'm really, really stretching out. I'm an entrepreneur.
Got a van.
Yes, a van, yeah. Man with a van. Oh, God.
A man with a van and a plan. That's,
yeah. You know,
that's how you make it in life, right?
I mean, question for the team. Do we get a van? Something that'll tow the car to comp? Something that we can probably throw
more people. Accurately, would someone send us a van?
Yes, absolutely.
Well, we could buy a van and just pay it off by offering it to the team as a, you know, living space for someone to rent until competition rolls around. You know, knowing the rent in Victoria, like, I'm sure
I still like the school bus idea.
Oh,
true. Yeah, I mean, I do like the rent a van idea though. That's, you might be onto something there, Jake.
Yeah,
I do. Would you know anyone by chance who'd maybe take up that rent offer?
Oh, I mean, depending on the price, but I'm pretty sure I could make do with a van. It's parked outside the shop, easy peasy. There's a fridge in the shop. That's
well, I also feel like if anyone,
and a microwave.
Exactly.
If anyone should be close to the shop, it's chassis.
Yeah. I mean, someone lived in the office for a while, so, you know, why can't you live in a van outside the shop?
Exactly.
Here's my man. Chassis, and this is where I was living when I designed.
We usually have fun pictures like that. Like one year it was like, hello design judges, this is where we build this car. And then the design judges were like, what, are you guys sure? And we're like, yeah, no, that's where we do it.
Yeah. Oh man, that's humbling.
We're punching above our weight class. That's where you want to be.
Exactly. Who doesn't love an underdog, right?
Exactly.
Oh man, how are we looking for time?
Well, I know Jacob already talked about what his ideal all the money and time in the world option would be.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't super fleshed out. I've got to be honest, I haven't really, like, being slapped in the face with a small budget, I haven't really daydreamed about having lots of money, but more just kind of roll with the punches on that one.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm sure I could come up with a more fleshed out idea at a later date, but.
And I guess part of the problem is there's not a lot of super exotic options, because the super exotic options other teams already do.
Yeah, it's like, okay, you have infinite money. All right, let's make everything out of carbon. All right, cool. But I mean, then you have to learn how to do topology studies and really focus on your layers, like your layups and geometry. And then it's a lot more heavily tied in with aero on kind of...
you'd be doing like a diffuser probably integrated into the chassis and all that stuff. So yeah, it becomes a bit more of a hassle as well.
Yeah. It becomes even more integrated with the rest of the systems. Not everything's just bolt on anymore.
Well, and even just bolting things on becomes a bit of a problem.
Yeah, well, because you need to put in like a sub plate in the layup to distribute the load. If you have any studs coming out of it, or, you know, if you want to have a hole going through it, you need to put some piece of either probably piece of 4130 steel or something to try and, you know, distribute that load and make it not break the carbon, because carbon is very happy until it is mildly hurt. It's a very fragile, very strong, but fragile substance.
Yeah, our suspension knows that all too well. All right, well, I feel like if you've got any last things, you're welcome to bring them up now, because I don't want to leave you with something that you wanted to bring up.
Yeah, honestly, I don't really have anything else that I feel the need to bring up. I feel like, you know, we covered safety, which is, you know, at least our number two priority.
maybe even three. I don't know. We'll see.
So at least third priority.
Yeah.
On a good day.
Yeah. Having a physical car, I think, is number one. Mm-hmm. I could talk a bit about manufacturing more, kind of like on the jig side of things. And then
I guess the jig side's probably an area that a lot of people don't necessarily think about. So it might be good to get some info out there.
Yeah. Okay. So to jig up the chassis, you know, I'm really hoping people listening to this, if there's anyone listening to this that maybe like isn't also on the team, but kind of have a picture of a chassis or like a FSAE frame that they've either seen before or in front of them. If not, this is going to be kind of confusing, but since it is just a series of tubes that are, you know, essentially floating in space, connected to one another. You need to, when you're putting it together, you need to figure out how they're actually going to go together. And you can try and eyeball it, which I think happened for a decent amount in 2019, because the whole thing was tacked together in one night, which is very impressive. But also the engine, when it got put in, the engine actually didn't come out. So, you know, that's kind of one of the downsides of improper jigging. And then the person welding it got angry and threw it and almost wrecked the engine. But, you know, that's fine. that's fine, right? We can afford another engine. No, we can't. but yeah, so when you're jigging it all together, it needs to be pretty precise so that, because you can design it to be really, really good, but if a tube is supposed to be in one place and it ends up somewhere else, your physical model isn't the same as your design, right? So the jig we have right now is like a steel skeleton with a bunch of 3D printed clamps and complex like 3D printed rings that hold the tubes together at their junctions, which hopefully will work. It's kind of untested at the moment, but we were trying to fix a lot of the problems that we were having with a plywood jig, which just tried to hold the tubes in place, but with 1/8 and 1/4 inch plywood, it's kind of floppy and it wasn't super accurate. So yeah, we have these rings that you stick the tubes into and clamp them together, if you can imagine that, to, you know, try and hold everything together in the right spot. But it's pretty complex. It took, like most things, it took way more work. The jig is like 93 pieces in total that, you know, tries to hold everything together. But yeah, like I said, it's untested, so hopefully it works well. If not, we need to work fast to change it. But otherwise, yeah, I don't know. That's it. It's kind of mundane, but it needs to be done.
Yeah. Well, just kind of like is a good statement for just how much like planning there is, you know, jigging stuff and then practice and then actually welding a car. Like it's a lot of stuff I feel like that could normally be missed, and then you get there and you're like, oh shoot, there's like twice the amount of work that we need to do.
Well, yeah, I mean, you have your like, you could finish your chassis design, and then, you know, I'm really glad we kind of changed our manufacturing process this year where the competition was online, because finishing the concept and modeling up the jig took about 2 months, 2 months to get it mostly finished, and kind of even 3 or 4 months to get everything sent out to actually be, you know, like manufactured, but, or to start sending things out to be manufactured. So it's, you know, you finish the chassis model and you think, okay, it's done. Now we can, you know, get it ordered and start putting it together. But no, you have all this work to do to be able to put it together properly. Which,
well, because you're doing yourself a disservice if you spend all of this time getting all the tubes in just the right position and doing all this work to make everything's just right, but then when you go to manufacture it, none of it's in the spot you designed it to be in.
Yeah, I mean, whatever you're making is only going to be as good as the tools you use to make it with, right? So if your design has a tolerance of 0.5 thou, but your, you know, jig has a tolerance of 1/8 of an inch, well, your tolerance isn't 0.5 thou then.
That's some good advice. And I will say, we have a surprising a number of international listeners. So it's not just people on the team.
Oh, really?
That is very good. Hopefully, if there's anyone that's doing chassis design, they get a little bit of something useful out of this. We'll see.
Yeah, plywood jigs are easy to make, but they don't work super well unless you put a lot of thought into them. As a forewarning.
That is our formula essay pro tip of the day.
Yeah. And when you weld things, they move a lot more than you think they're going to.
Yeah, that's another big one. When you're welding and then you instead of like doing a little bit and then going and moving over to do something else while that cools down, and you just go, I'm just going to do the whole thing. Not going to go well for you.
Yeah.
Tube migration exists.
Exactly. Heat deformation is everything. Yeah. I know on some bigger stuff, we were, this is a completely different project, but to give kind of an idea on, also this was pretty big, it was a 15-foot tube, but it was a 2x3-inch tube with, you know, 1/8-inch thick walls. So it was a pretty stiff piece of material, and it was probably about 15 feet long. And we just welded a bunch of tabs to one side of it, and it visibly looked kind of banana shaped at the end. So I was like, oh, right, well, we need to try to do something to bring this back into straight.
All right. Well, with our pro tip of the day, I think we can wrap this one up. And thanks, Jacob, for this one.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It was good to talk about stuff.
And thanks for everybody tuning in all over the world.